It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
Tangier is facing an uncertain future as it loses its landmass to erosion and the rising sea level. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. In the summer of 1608, Captain John Smith started out his exploration of the Chesapeake Bay and ran across Tangier Island. It was much bigger then. It's now down to about 789 acres, and within 50 years, the U.S. government predicts another third will be gone. It is an island with a rich history and an enduring people, and it has been captured in a new book, Chesapeake Requiem, A Year with the Watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island. And we have the author, Earl Swift, on the line with us this morning. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Don. Happy to be here.
So, first of all, how did you get attracted or interested in this island?
Well, I spent 21 years as a reporter for the Virginian Pilot, the newspaper in Norfolk, and was sent to the island on a couple of assignments back in 1999, one of them being the millennium. I spent Y2K on Tangier. And insofar as it's a dry island and a near theocracy of old school Methodists, it was one of the quietest millennial celebrations on the planet, I'm betting. And during that visit, I spoke to a lot of islanders, and they told me that the waters that for centuries had sustained Tangier with its fish, crabs, and oysters was now poised to erase it. And I went back in 2000. Spent 6 weeks on and off with a photographer on the island, and put together a newspaper package of newspaper stories about Tangier's existential plight at that point. And then I left for 15 years, and during that time lived near the water in Norfolk and watched the water climb higher up into my yard and higher in my basement with each storm that came along, each astronomical high tide, and got to thinking that if the situation were this bad on the mainland, it had to be getting pretty dire out in Tangier. And so in the fall of 2015, resolved to go back and get a closer look.
Describe for me physically what the island looks like in terms of its major features.
Well, it's about 3 miles long and a mile wide. It's essentially a whisper of salt marsh surrounded by a lot of water, 18 trillion gallons of water in the lower Chesapeake. It's smack in the middle of the bay's widest point, 12 miles from the nearest mainland port. And it's incredibly low-lying. The high point on the island is 5 feet, but it rarely clears 3 feet in elevation. And because most of it is salt marsh, the great majority of the island fails to clear 1 foot above the tides.
And so what are some of its major features? I mean, you have upards, I guess, and meat soup and Canaan and Canton and so on. Describe for us a little bit about those, what those were like.
Well, this is an island that for most of its history has been shaped roughly like a seahorse. And if you picture a seahorse facing to the right with a curly tail, it had a 2 mile long spit, sand spit at its southern end. The body of the seahorse is where all of the people on Tangier live. There are 460 residents, and they're crowded onto three what are called ridges. They're parallel ribs of sandy loam that rise just inches above the marsh. And then the head of the seahorse, separated from the body by a boat channel, is uninhabited marsh that islanders call upards. And at one point, it was inhabited. There were four or five different little settlements on upards. All have been abandoned, and most of at this point are underwater and well offshore.
So give me a sense about the history here. I mean, I mentioned a moment ago that John Smith ran across it, but it has this sort of interesting history in which there's a lot of activity, which certainly goes through the oyster and crab boom, as it were, and then it peters out, I guess, somewhere around the early 20th century. Give us some sense about that landscape.
Well, it was mapped first by John Smith in 1608. It was settled by a guy named Joseph Crockett in 1778. And most everybody on the island can trace his or her lineage back to that original settler. So this is an island of cousins or closer. It's one big extended family. There are about a half dozen surnames that most people on the island answer to. It has been, since the very early 19th century, almost wholly dependent on the bay for its sustenance. First fish, later oysters through most of the 19th century, and then since about 1900 on the blue crab. And it is the largest source of soft shell crab in the bay. So if you're eating at a restaurant in Philadelphia, Wilmington, New York, any of the big cities of the Mid-Atlantic, and you have soft shell in your plate, there's a reasonable chance that it was a Tangier crabber who caught it and delivered it to market. Since, I guess, in about the last 30 years or so, the age-old pattern of island sons following their fathers onto the water has faded, and really can kind of trace it to the arrival of satellite TV, which provided young islanders with insight that there were much easier and less uncertain ways to make a living than to climb aboard a little boat and go out into big water every day. And since the mid-80s, an increasing percentage of island youngsters have decided to go off to college or to the military or to offshore jobs after graduating from high school. And consequently, the average age of crabbers has steadily grown. The average age on the island has steadily grown. It's now in the mid-50s. And a very large percentage of the whole are people in their 70s, 80s, and 90s.
Now, religion obviously plays a great role on this island. You mentioned a moment ago Methodists. Describe a little for me how the Methodists arrived there, that particular form of Protestantism, and how has it wielded or welded together this and shaped the morals and the viewpoints of the people that you met?
Well, for much of its history, Tangier has been a working theocracy, and you mentioned the Methodist Church, and Methodism arrived on the island in 1807. It was brought there by one of the islanders, a guy named Joshua Thomas, who's credited with spreading the word of Methodism throughout much of the Chesapeake Bay region. And he was attracted to it really isn't such a surprise, I guess, if you consider that much about daily life in Tangier is beyond one's control. You know, when you make your living on the water, you operate at the whims of nature, and the Chesapeake Bay can be a scary place to make a living in a small boat, and so prayer has been kind of a rock for Tangier since Joshua Thomas brought it aboard. And you know, throughout the 19th century, really throughout all of the 20th century, it was the defining characteristic of Tangier. Everybody, you know, there was a time when on a Sunday morning you didn't see a soul outside of Swain United Methodist Church. It's pretty much every islander was shoehorned into that building. It's lost some of its grip on the population in recent years, and a good number of Tangiermen belong to a breakaway flock of conservative Christians. Both churches are evangelical, but both still fulfill the same function that the church did when Joshua Thomas brought it aboard, which is to fortify islanders against so many of the challenges they face. You know, this is hurricane bait, this little island, and it's been hammered many times by storms in the past, and it's always managed to eke its way through. Islanders will tell you that that's because they're an anointed people, that anointed by the power of prayer, and they believe that it will get them through the existential crisis they face now.
Heather, you also, of course, interviewed and talked a lot with the mayor, who obviously became a bit of national note when President Trump actually called him up. Describe a little bit about what he was like and how he fits into this menu that you paint about this very tightly knit island.
James Uecker Eskridge is the mayor. He's 60 years old. He's tall, lean, kind of a ruggedly handsome guy with a Magnum PI mustache and ice blue eyes and a strong Tangier accent. And the accent on Tangier is worth noting because this is a group of people who have been isolated for so long that they have developed their own style of speech. It's a dialect really unlike any other in the country. It's a mixture of kind of the Tidewater hoi-toid accent and kind of a Cornish lilt. Almost sounds Irish at times. And Tangiermen tend to stretch single-syllable words into multiple syllables. And on, layered on top of all that is their habit of often saying exactly the opposite of what they mean. So if you were to overhear a couple of Islanders talking to each other, you'd be hard-pressed to pick out a word. And if you could pick out the words, you still might not understand what was being said. So Uecker has one of these accents, but has a very limber vocabulary. He's a very well-spoken guy. High school education, which for a guy of 60 is unusual on Tangier. People of the boys of Uecker's generation drop out of high school at 14 or 15 and went to work on the water with their dads and eventually got their own boats. And like many Tangiermen, he is a staunch conservative. He's part of the 88% of the island who voted for Donald Trump in 2016. He's a pretty militant follower of the president. And in 2017, he gained the notoriety you mentioned when CNN came to the island to do a story that was kind of built around the notion that here was an island imperiled by rising seas that had voted overwhelmingly for a president who considered climate change a hoax. So that central paradox was kind of the hub on which their story turned. And one of the scenes in this story, as aired, took place at a daily coffee clatch of old-timers that Uecker was attending. And during an interview with CNN's Jennifer Gray, a meteorologist with the network, Uecker declared that he loved Trump, quote, as much as any family member I got, end quote. Well, that created a sensation as soon as it aired. And 3 days later, the president called Uecker and reassured him that he had nothing to worry about. And Uecker quoted him as saying that Tangier Island had been there for hundreds of years and would be there for hundreds more. A lot of islanders were reassured by that. The world off the island wasn't quite as reassured. It became quite a story.
Let me ask you: why is it that, as I understand it from the book, Uecker and others really look at erosion as being the principal problem, as opposed to sea level rise? And oftentimes, as you mentioned a moment ago, don't believe that the sea is actually rising in terms of its levels. Why are those such contradictory notions in their own mind? Why do they reject one as opposed to the other? I mean, why couldn't one just accept both?
Well, it's frustrating because it really is it's semantic hair splitting when you get down to it, because sea level rise and erosion are not mutually exclusive. They're interlinked. The higher the waters rise, the worse the effects of the erosion. And there's no question that Tangier does suffer from wind drip and wave erosion. It's been going on for 150 years. But the idea that the rising seas have nothing to do with it is, I think misplaced. Well, I know it is. The thing about Tangier that you need to understand is that there's a suspicion of science on the part of many in the population, and that's born in part because for years they've differed with scientists on matters related to crabbing, on the health of the bay, on the health of the crab population in the bay, on the effects of fishing or overfishing on that crab population. At any number of junctures, Tangiermen have found themselves opposing the scientific view, which has run counter to their more anecdotal learning, their anecdotal knowledge of what they're actually seeing when they pull up their pots. And so that's the backdrop for for this discussion about sea level rise versus erosion. Tangiermen can see erosion. They can't really see the seas coming up. And part of that is that Tangier has soft edges. This is a marsh island. There's no shoreline, really, in which it's easy to measure a rising sea. And even if there were, I mean, this is a sea that this is incremental change that kind of defies eyeballing. It's not something you can actually gauge if you're observing it every day. It sneaks up on you, and it particularly sneaks up on you on a marsh island with soft edges, because its effects are not what you'd expect. I mean, when seas rise around a marsh island, what they do is they drown marsh. The marsh cannot live underwater. It has to exist right at the tide line, really. And so what you've seen over the last half century certainly is a great deal of marsh, both around the island's edges and within its interior too, slowly succumb to rising seas by drowning and becoming patches of open water. You've seen upland, high and dry land, become marsh. So you've seen the slow transformation of the nature of Tangier's actual stuff take place. And that's not easy to gauge watching it every day. I think that if you were to take Tangiermen up in an airplane or a helicopter and have them just hover over pieces of the island, they'd be astounded, because upwards, that uninhabited marsh to the north of the inhabited part of the island, was, when I first visited there in 2000, was a pretty solid expanse of wetland. Now it's just a loose macrame of land. It's just strings of marsh. Most of it has turned to water. And that's not something you can really see when you're down standing on the deck of a boat. It's not something you can see standing on land. You have to be elevated. You have to look down on it. And there the changes are just astounding and quite alarming.
I want to turn to the women on the island, because you sort of indicate that there's a sense that the women are really running the show, as it were, in many ways. That is, it carrying out all the tasks as the men go out to sea. Describe their role in that society.
Well, their role is to hold the whole thing together. I mean, maybe that's their role every place. But in Tangier, you see it because the men are gone all day. You know, they're either off on their boats crabbing, or they're off for 2 weeks at a stretch on tugboats. Whatever they're up to, they're not present to actually run things. And consequently, women run not only all of the island's institutions, ranging from the school to the post office to the museum to really even the churches. They also manage the island's primitive but incredibly effective communications network, and they really are the source for island opinion. They shape it far ahead of the men, and I think that it's in many ways a patriarchal society. This is a place with pretty old school values in terms of the man, as the head of the family and such. But that's not to say that he actually decides anything. It's the women who run the show.
So, as you indicated a moment ago, that the island seems to be changing, not just simply in terms of, obviously, the environmental issue, but also that at one point you could go, as you indicated, and, geez, you could see them all in church. And then you came back and you found that there were these signs that perhaps the world had intruded, that things were not as they once were.
Yeah, that's true. And when I put together the package for the newspaper in 2000, the way I couched it was that there were multiple forms of erosion taking hold in Tangier, not only the physical chipping away at its perimeter, but culturally the church was losing its grip. And really, perhaps most significantly, demographically, because Tangier is suffering a pretty severe population loss. Severe and steady. When I was there in 2000, the population stood at 604, and there were 100 students enrolled at the Tangier Combined School, which is the only K through 12 school left in Virginia. When I got back there in 2016 to spend 14 months living on the island for this book, the island's population had dropped from 604 to about 470, or a 20% drop in 16 years. And the school population had dropped from 100 students to 67 at that point. Next year, it's going to be down to 53. So it's, you know, you reach a point, on, especially in an island community, where you no longer have the human critical mass to support some essential town services. And whereas on the mainland, if you live in a small town and the grocery store closes, it's pretty inconvenient, but you get in your car and you drive 5 or 10 miles to the next town and you go to the grocery store there. Not easy to do on Tangier. If the grocery store were to close on Tangier, it would invite hardship, a significant hardship, onto a population that is largely elderly, unable to go to the mainland to go shopping once a week or, you know, frequently. And so you have a, you know, that looms as a bit of a tipping point. And so that the demographic erosion that you see taking place is almost in a race with the physical destruction of the island in terms of which will spell its end first.
You have, by the way, just sort of towards the end of the book, you talk about this, you just have the scene of these boats, I think it's during oystering, where they are literally one on top of the other. Describe a little bit about that and how you were able to find the descriptions that you have there of these people. I mean, literally, they're on top of one another, which is not something I would have thought of since, you know, the waters are big. But nonetheless, they seem to be competing almost head-to-head.
Yeah, well, it surprised me, too, Don. The seasons work like this. A Tangier waterman, and it's called a waterman because it goes after more than one kind of seafood. A Tangier waterman works the water for crabs from March until late October, and then oysters from December to the end of February. And it's a very solitary pursuit when you're crabbing. You have crab pots out. Nobody else can touch your pots, so you're often miles away from the next boat. Oystering, however, although the water is big, the oyster rocks on which wild oysters cluster, those are small. And so you often have dozens of boats crowded over these rocks, all dredging, pulling big steel dredges, a couple feet wide, trailed by a rope bag, much like a lawnmower bag. You have these boats jockeying for position over these rocks. And you get a couple dozen, three dozen boats doing that all at once, and it begins to look like a dogfight during the Battle of Britain. I mean, they are circling each other very tightly. We're talking coming within, you know, 3-4 feet of each other routinely. And meanwhile, it's the dead of winter. The wind's blowing. It's cold as all get out. The spray is coming off the water and freezing on every surface on the boat and the surface of the water. Generally already wind roiled, is kicked up into a froth by all of this boat activity. So you've got the boat, the deck is heaving and yawing and rolling under your boots, while you're cutting these arcing licks, as they're called, with your dredge, and trying to avoid running into all of your neighbors who are around you in every direction. It's really exciting and kind of terrifying, and it was something I had no reason to expect, and it was amazed to experience.
Avad, you sort of wrap up the book with obviously there's a loss of one of the watermen, and you describe how the community comes together at a moment's notice once the word spreads that somebody has been lost out. Describe that reaction for me, because it seems like everybody got into it almost all at once.
Yeah, they sure did. This was in April 2017. A very well-respected, experienced crabber named Ed Charnock, who was 70 years old, went out with his son Jason, who was 40, and they're both the Henrietta Sea. and they ran into trouble in some worsening weather many miles to the west of Tangier. One of the challenges of crabbing or working the water at all from Tangier is that you've got a lot of open water, miles in any direction, and that creates a lot of what mariners call fetch, which is basically just room to build waves. And in this particular day, the wind was coming along at a really good clip. When they got into trouble, it was blowing at 35 miles per hour, and the seas were running 5 to 6 feet high. And the Henrietta Sea started taking on water and eventually went down, and Ed and Jason were pitched into the water, and they had time to get one SOS radio call out. And it was heard by a Tangierman, relayed to the island, and within minutes, every boat, available boat on the island, was headed west into that storm, into the teeth of a storm that all 50 men on those boats knew had already claimed one of the most capable captains among them. And I think that's a remarkable demonstration of just what community means on Tangier. This is not your typical small town. And not just because everybody's related in one form or another, but just because they have had to rely on each other for generations merely to survive, to get through the, you know, the crabbing season, through the winter. They are literally willing to die for each other, and they demonstrated that day. 20 boats, 50 island men, virtually every available able-bodied man on the island went out, not sure where Ed and Jason were, but held bent on trying to save them, and went out at the absolute worst point of that storm. It was a tragic day. Ed lost his life. But I think the day has stayed with me more for that reaction than for the tragedy. It said a lot about Tangier.
We've been speaking with Earl Swift. He's author of a new book, Chesapeake Requiem, A Year with the Watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island. And we appreciate you taking the time to talk with us this morning.
Don, it's been my pleasure.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. Laura Botinelli is leaving the Ward Museum. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Laura has been executive director of the Ward Museum of Wildfowl Art in Salisbury for the last 12 years, a total of 16 years there, and it has preserved the art of decoy carving, displaying exhibits that range from older working decoys to the decorative kind. The museum is named after the two most famous carvers on the Eastern Shore, Lim and Stephen Ward. And to take a look back at our time at the museum, we have Laura in the studio. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
So, well, let me ask you this. So I hear that there has been a caricature outside your office with the words in a little bubble above your head that were not just about ducks. Is that your...
That is very true.
Has that been your main theme or your guiding light there?
It definitely was something that needed to be said a decade ago. I just like that caricature now. But the Ward Museum is not just about ducks. And anyone who's listening is probably saying, oh, really? Because you have to come and find out why.
So so how did you come about getting to the Ward Museum?
So I started at the Ward Museum fresh out of grad school. I came as the museum's curator and folklorist. We had just received a grant from the Maryland Arts Council and their Maryland Traditions Program. And somehow my background, I was uniquely qualified for this job. I had, while I was doing my master's work at University of Wyoming, I had worked with the National Museum of Wildlife Art on some exhibitions related to wildlife art. And then when I was an undergrad at Rutgers, I ended up having to write some encyclopedia articles for the Encyclopedia of New Jersey. And my topics included New Jersey decoys and New Jersey boats and the Pineys. So all this thing about, you know, folk culture, traditional life ways, and then the outdoors, especially with the National Museum of Wildlife Art, sort of set me up to be able to come to the museum as a curator. And a lot has happened since.
So you came to the Eastern Shore. Mm-hmm. What was that like? Well, from where you came?
I'm originally from southern New Jersey. And okay. There's a lot of similar aspects of living on the Lower Eastern Shore as southern New Jersey. A lot of those working maritime communities that you would find along the Lower Delaware Bay or the coastal trades of the New Jersey coast, those were things I grew up with. And so we have a very comparable thing here with the Chesapeake Bay and the Atlantic Ocean community. So it was different, but enjoyable. And obviously it had this distinct Chesapeake-ness.
That's true. So how did you find in terms of your reaction to the area, what was that like? And did you find yourself adjusting to the shore and its particular ways?
Yeah, I lived in Salisbury, in the city of Salisbury for the first 12 or longer years. So, I was able to bike to work. So I was living in a city. But then anytime you turned around, you'd drive out of town, you'd be in a farm field or you'd be in a marsh or you'd be on a bridge somewhere. And I found it incredibly refreshing as someone, I have this very, as much as I love culture and the arts, I'm an environmentalist. And so the ability to connect with the outdoors, you had a lot of water access, the horizons of Delmarva are beautiful. So I fit in well, like comfortably into the place of Delmarva. And through my work, I was invited into all kinds of nooks and crannies of the shore. My first 4 years at the museum was basically doing survey field work of cultural communities of the shore. Obviously spent a lot of time down in Somerset County, Crisfield, Smith Island. But, I got into backwaters of Cambridge and the Blackwater Wildlife Refuge and just people who were showing me around, introducing me to artists, to tradition bearers. And so it became a very familiar place very quickly for me. And I kind of drive around now and find myself somewhere I hadn't been in 10 years. And I still remember the person's house that we, sat and had coffee in. So,
right.
Yeah, it's a kind of like a journalist in a way.
That's true. That's mm-hmm. right. Always moving around. That's true. So what was your reaction to the watermen? I mean, the kind of people they are.
Well, they were gentlemen. That's the first reaction, is that there was always a kindness and a welcomeness and you knew you were talking to somebody with a soul, somebody who was connected to their life, their work, their place, their family, their religion, that knew the water, and they were willing to talk to me. So I thought that it was a perfect match. And being able to get out on the water, I love place naming. I think it's really important the way that local cultures name places, all the informal place names. And when you're on the water and the wayfinding on the water and the way that landmarks are described, like Puppy Hole outside of Crisfield, like it's this great fishing grounds. And mm-hmm. it's, because you can pull in big puppies out of there. but that kind of stuff. And I know that my appreciation for that part of what they do made it an easy contact, connection.
Any particular waterman stand out?
Hun Lawson from Crisfield. So he had been retired at that point, but he was an incredible storyteller. In fact, I think maybe go down as a storyteller more than his history as a waterman. But his ability sort of capture and talk about the Eastern Shore. He even received like a Master Apprenticeship Award in storytelling from the Maryland Arts Council. But yeah, it's those... I love the work, but I love the lore.
let's first of all tell people a little bit about the Ward Museum and the most famous, as I indicated a moment ago, Lemon Stephen Ward.
Okay, so I just think it's perfect that the Ward Museum is named for these fabulous decoy carvers from Crisfield. And while we love our patrons, to know that the museum that is preserving and carrying the history of Delmarva is named for these decoy makers, I think is just perfect. So their collection is housed at the museum. A portion, obviously, other people have Ward Brothers decoys, but our collection connects the story of these two men, carvers from Crisfield, to a broader story of wildlife art and wildfowl carving. And then ultimately, to the lifeways of Delmarva, to the Chesapeake Bay, and to art and nature inspired by tradition. you know, the Ward brothers were remarkable because their artwork made you feel the place that they lived. They had an attitude in their work, the way the birds expressed themselves, the creativity that Lem would put into it to bring things to life in a way. You know, they're the perfect example of American folk art, Lem's carvings. You think of a quilt. A quilt is on your bed to keep you warm. But the applications on quilts, all the beauty of the quilt is that utilitarian having a decorative quality. That's what was going on with the decoys and what Lem was doing. You'd have a decoy, which was a tool, but then all the decorative quality, all the artistry that the human put into it, because it doesn't just need to be a tool. It's something beautiful that's around us, and let's let it capture our feelings. So it fit really well for my interests related to understanding the connections between people, place, and culture. And it was a really, the Ward brothers were a really easy way to start a conversation with others about, well, how does your tradition connect to your interests artistically or creatively, or to the outdoors, or to your sense of community, or to your neighbors? And that could be from a farmer to a waterman to a politician.
Right.
Anyone. I mean, that's the, as a folklorist, that's our profession, is being able to connect the sort of experience that we have as people to these richer art and cultural feelings.
Well, one of the things is we did a piece talking to a couple of the carvers, and the thing that really struck me about the carvers, both of them, was that they were dealing with obviously they were carving the decoys, but then they were painting them and doing this sort of thing. Matter of fact, one of them said they could get lost in painting them, and that sort of stood in contrast to the physical image of these kind of husky guys. You know, they don't look as if, you know, they're not. If you looked at them, you would not think of them as artists. I mean, what do you make of that?
It's interesting because they as artists, they don't fit a mold.
Right.
Right. And whether there should be a mold for an artist, I mean, I say everyone's an artist in their own way. But, you know, when we go to our competitions at Ocean City, and everyone has, there's thousands of artworks that are out on the table being judged, having ribbons, and basically everyone is wearing their egos on their sleeve. But the external factor is you have some, you know, pretty tough looking guys that
Eastern
are
Shore guys.
Yeah, that that have just laid their heart and soul out on the table. Mm. And then I think that's good. I mean, I think that's important that, you know, in whatever work you do, is that you find the way for your creativity to come through. And then you hope that you're supported by others and others encourage you.
Any particular artist that's had any particular decoy carver you it comes to mind that
oh, I'll get in trouble.
Well, I mean, Bob did a couple of them. I mean,
oh, so let's see. So what's the question? Yeah, you're putting me on the spot. So, I shall allow my friends to be humble in their ability to carry their emotions.
Is that right?
So.
In terms of the, you alluded to this at the beginning, that you saw the museum as more than just simply a collection of decoys. Tell me a little bit about how you try to connect with the community, and was it particular change that do you think that you brought to the museum?
Okay, well, I have a couple of little thoughts going on here. Yeah. So, one of the things was to make our story more accessible. It wasn't about decoys, and it wasn't about bird sculptures. You know, it's about art and nature and tradition. So that allowed more people to connect. But the other thing that was really easy to get people to start falling in love with the museum is connect our story to food. One of the most important series that I did in my first years at the Ward Museum, it was called Delmarva Cooks. And we brought in all these community cooks from throughout Delmarva cooking traditional Eastern Shore fare. Well, guess what? Waterfowl was in there. We did ducks and geese, and then we did venison, and then we did muskrat and turtle and oysters and crabs and whatever. But the story of the Ward Museum's collection, it is a foodway story. in the very basis of what was happening, people needed to eat and they started carving decoys. And people have been fooling birds to be able to eat them for millennia. I mean, we're hungry. So that was just making these other ways to plug in. And then a different spin on that was when there's only so many folks who can invest their time into carving. You know, while it is an important art form. Some people use it as an important hobby, that it is very time consuming. And what was happening was there was this other flare-up of activity, which was all the nature photographers and digital photography as a way for people to connect with the outdoors, to document their experience and be creative in their celebration of nature. And so when we started holding our nature photography competition, I guess it's been 8 or 9 years now, it was like a whole new way to connect with artists and amateurs and professionals that were just in these places, in these nooks and crannies, enduring nature and documenting its beauty. That's what's happening in bird carving, too. It's just, you know, how long does it take to carve the bird? And then there's thousands of people out there with their digital camera on their shoulder. I say, and someone can yell, that if Lem and Steve Ward were alive today, Lem would have a digital camera on his shoulder when he was out there on Jenkins Creek. I mean, he'd have his own portfolio of documenting the beauty out there. They called themselves Wildfowl Counterfeiters in Wood, which is this really kind of interesting play on words. And so when you think about the way these pictures bring you into those settings, of course, Lem would have used that as one of his tools. He'd use any tool in his get his hands on. So,
as a matter of fact, yes, we have definitely noted that I think it was a piece it is, and they take the, I think it was from the tomato baskets or whatever, and just and literally utilize that wood.
Yeah, and it's again, it's, we're jumping around a bit, but the sure. ingenuity of folks to, I mean, the museum had to have that ingenuity to break out of this box, and right. it very much reflects the way Lem and Steve made it way through their life. You know, what opportunities were available to you now? Who's coming into your community? What do people need? How do you make a living? And so the museum's figured out how to make that living, which is great. And we brought thousands of new people into what we think are important themes in the process. You know, people say, well, what is the Ward Museum? And I say, is it an art museum? Yes. Is it a history museum? Yes. Is it a nature center? Yes. Is it a community center? Yes. You can say yes to all those things. You may come because you think it's a great art museum, but then you stay because it's a community center. So, and I think that during my tenure there, sometimes we've been more of one of those things, but it's important to have places to pivot.
Now, you have a couple of competitions that you hold each year. I mean, in terms mm-hmm. of, tell us a little bit about that. I was at the one, I guess, in Ocean City, which mm-hmm. literally the big, gigantic tables with all kinds of really interesting carvings.
Yeah, I think that the World Championship really tells your listeners, well, why is this museum there in Maryland? And who are all the people that support it? So there's our locals, but we have members in all 50 states and 10 countries. And these are artists and supporters of the arts who have engaged with the World Championship that we hold every year. Last year, we had an artist from Japan and Norway and Barbados and the Netherlands and Scotland and Canada, the United States, that competed. So each one of those artists have their network, and they see how the Ward Museum supports their growth, and then they support the museum. And for Salisbury, Maryland, Eastern Shore, to have this sort of epicenter of this artist community be its base is amazing. And again, these audiences the museum have, sometimes we're speaking quite clearly to our international bird carving community. And sometimes we're talking to the folks that, you know, live on Shoemaker Pond because we're doing some sort of water quality thing on the pond. But the competitions are, competition is a really important way for people to get together and to show their work. And it's a shame because most of the people who come end up losers. There aren't that many awards.
Well,
and when
true.
You have 1,000, and when you go in, it's about exhibition, right? So the point of the competition is you might make it and you get that blue ribbon or red ribbon or the cash.
Right.
But the majority of the people who come, those thousands of artworks that end on that table in Ocean City, they came for exhibition. They came to be able to show off what they could do. And if they get lucky, they win. And that was one of the hard things when we started doing the photography competition. It was that that community hadn't been regularly losing. So, like, we wallpapered the museum. It was over 1,000 photographs. And we had, 24 winners? So Everyone was coming on Sunday morning to pick up their photographs, and it was a bit disappointing. But really, the exhibition and the power of the exhibition of all those artworks coming together is the point. The competition is this other bit of it. But those places where artists can gather, they can share ideas, they can build relationships is what I think one of the most important things a museum does.
Now, the museum, as we should say, is located on Shoemaker Pond. And you, I guess you arrived there, what, a few years, I think, after it was built, I think?
The brief hurdles of time.
Because you start with the foundation, I think,
68. Yeah. And so it's their 50th anniversary. So 1968, the Ward Foundation was established. Its first activities were to hold competitions and exhibitions. In 76, it gets its first home at Salisbury University in Holloway Hall. In 91, the foundation opens the facility on Shoemaker Pond that everyone knows now. And then in the year 2000, we married SU, where we merged our assets together and became partners with SU. And then I came in 2002. So I came right after the university marriage, and then it was the chance to basically show that we can make this thing work. And it's been good.
So what has it been like working with the university?
Wonderful. It has. Every year we get it's all relationship based. You know, there's the faculty and students who we can engage and allow to support our exhibitions or educational programming. But this giant fabric of campus between the administrators and the IT and the folks that are in community residential life, those relationships are many, far and deep. And so they've regularly and reliably come to our assistance. And I think we have each mutually benefited from the relationship. One of our friends in IT, I won't share his name, they call us AFFs.
Which
affiliated
is?
Friends forever. You're our AFF because we're an affiliated foundation.
Right.
And so I think it does speak to that there's this bond and some of it very, you know, on paper, but then there's this, the museums can support the university's student engagement, community engagement objectives, and I think we've done well at that.
So how many people do you think go through the museum every year?
We're counting up FY18 now. Last year it was 50,000 was our contact, and it's going to be, the last fiscal year is going to beat that. We've seen an amazing increase in foot traffic in the past 6 to 8 months. We finished construction of the new Legacy Center. And so people are using that space. That museum, that parking lot is almost never empty anymore. So there's all the folks who are coming through to utilize the new facility. And then like right now, August is free admission for locals because we had a corporate sponsor, Value Carpet One, that underwrote the cost of local admission. So now local foot traffic is up. And programs have stronger attendance. So it's been... We're in this growth period at the museum with all the activities we have. Lots of stuff is working, and now we just want to maintain the success. But yeah, the business of the museum has certainly changed since I started there. And it's good.
You mentioned that there's a new facility. What do you do in the new facility?
So it's 2,200 square feet, waterfront, classroom space, but it's basically this beautiful gem. It's got all windows, hardwood floor, looking out over Shoemaker Pond, a private meeting room. It was built as a classroom, and so they do a lot of learning activities in there. But it can be, right now, there's one of the faculty groups from SU is having a retreat. That's in the building right now. You can rent it for parties and weddings and receptions and all sorts of things. It's not our best kept secret anymore because people are finding out. So come on over and check it out. That's all I can say. You'll be surprised.
So one of the things, by the way, a large component, at least in the past, in terms of people going through the museum has been children.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me a little bit about that and how they react to what they're seeing.
Well, we have a lot of children that come through the museum now. I think this year's number is something like 23,000 student contacts. And So what do they get to do? What is their reaction? First, they're surprised, just like the grown-ups are surprised when they get into the decorative gallery. They can't imagine that it's not a real bird. But usually what had happened before they get to the galleries is they had done this, the series is they have a welcome introduction. They do their nature trail walk. So they get to observe wildlife in its natural setting. We have a very rich scattering of birds along the pond. And then when they go into the galleries, they can then have the conversation about how someone connected that experience of discovery, of spotting those birds, and then pushing that into art. And then also into the things with the decoys is that you're then even trying to even mimic what the bird does, the way it floats on the water and the way it looks. And so it's an it's easy to connect with a young mind. Our educators have come up with a variety of strategies. There's a lot of physical learning too, because it's important on these excursions that the kids get to move around, that they're not just sort of set in place. And so now they have all these, there's a education word for it when you use your body. Sorry, educators.
But and, we use that. Okay.
Yes. And they are able to like mimic birds flying and other types of the way that migration patterns work. And it's done with the kids moving around because motion and education is very important, the hands-on learning. So, and it's all interdisciplinary. So even if you came in for a science program, you're going to get some art. And if you came in for an art program, you're going to get some science and history. So we've done a great job with the statewide curricula to make sure we fulfill all the learning objectives for the teachers. And for those teachers that are listening, just call and we'll tell you why.
And how old are the kids? I mean,
we go from pre-K to college.
To college?
I mean, we go from pre-K to 80. I mean,
well, yeah.
It's
and we're kids by then again.
Yeah. So it goes all the way. But we have tailored lessons for all different levels of learning.
So I mean, if one goes through the museum, one sees some rather remarkable carvings. As you say, some of them look as if they're very, very real, including obviously the famous feather comparison, I guess. How do people react to the feather? Can people tell the difference between the two?
The way they react is they never forget it, because we took that exhibit down once and we got phone calls. <It's> like, so there's always now. For your listeners, there's these a real feather and a card feather, and you basically can't tell the difference. And it's a really easy way to illustrate how the quality and the detail of what the artist is being able to capture. And I don't know why it sticks, but it just sticks, obviously.
So amongst all those, any one particular stick out at you or that you thought was a remarkable?
I have my favorite.
What was your favorite?
I have my favorite carving. It's a Ward Brothers preening widgeon. And so a widgeon's a duck. And it has its one wing tilted up. And so the way Lem did it, it's just this beautiful tapestry. I mean, it's the feathers of a bird, but it's just stacked and textured in a way that's just remarkable. It's a beautiful piece of folk art. And it's subtle and it's delicate, but it's still just a bird. It's just like one of the, like I was getting back to with quilting, is that it's the artist is taking everything that they learn from their daily life experience, and this thing that used to be a tool, you know, has this work function, and now it's something that's inspired. It's beautiful. But yeah, this preening widgeon photo is available on the Ward Museum website.
So the sense I get in is that the museum really grown over the last 12 to 16 years, and in your view, I mean, in terms of
it has,
and so on.
SU's been a big part of that for sure. It was very much a stabilizing factor, and getting the connections with the faculty and getting student interns in and all of that. But again, in the process of opening up our programming and our mission to remain relevant, I mean, the museum pivoted into the 21st century at that period. You know, the 21st century learning and living experience is far different than the way that place was when we imagined that place for the founders. So we've made that jump. And so let's hope that they can carry it forward.
So what are you going to miss?
What am I going to miss?
Yeah, when you leave.
People. Even though I'm a material culture person, I'm a people person. There's lots of wonderful people, the artists and then my coworkers and the volunteers and even just across campus, the people that appreciate and get. I know you get the Ward Museum. I figured that out. You've had me come over and talk several times, and I know you get it. So that's what I miss is it'll be that ability to just pick up the conversation. But I'll just pick it up where I left off next time I'm in town.
It's okay. And you can be that often? Maybe. I don't know.
Right? I like a lot of people around here, so I'll probably come back.
You'll probably come back. Any final thoughts about for people who are going to couldn't miss having you around?
I know. If you say, Laura's leaving, well, come to the Ward Museum on October 12th. Okay. That's the 50th anniversary celebration. It is a big party that was already planned before I was leaving to celebrate our golden anniversary. And there'll be an auction, and there'll be food, and there'll be drink and merriment and all kinds of things. Tommy Linton is Lem Ward's grandson, and he's coming up special for the event. We're going to be giving a special thank you to Dr. Janet, Salisbury University, for her support of the museum. So it'll be a great gathering. And then the next day, I'll still be at the museum, and I'll be doing a longer sort of session with Tommy Linton, Lem Ward's grandson. That'll be like my bow. My final out will be to do a long sit down with him about his life with the Ward brothers and things that he'd experienced. So you can come and see me at either one of those and I'll give you a hug.
Well, there you go. Well, she's of course moving on and we're going to keep that a secret until later, so people are just going to have to wait to find out where you're going.
Oh, thanks.
But Laura, I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you.
And, of course, we've been talking with Laura Bartonelli. She's the executive director of the Ward Museum of Wildfowl Art here in Salisbury and is moving on, and we appreciate you stopping by. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC 14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit pac14.org.